They are walking together now. They are swaying ever so slowly as they take one step after another up the long hill, slowly, slowly moving up toward the temple in Jerusalem. They're moving up that ancient hill that is known as Mount Zion as they walk up toward the temple for worship. And as you listen carefully, you notice that they are singing. Or perhaps you would call it chanting as they go. They're singing and chanting the words of the 126th Psalm, the one that we just read, as they walk and sway slowly upward, up, up, up this hill. The 126th Psalm is known as a psalm of ascent. What that means is that the ancient Jewish community would sing or chant this psalm as they moved up toward the temple for their service of worship. This particular psalm was written some years or decades after the psalm that we looked at last Sunday. If you remember, last Sunday's psalm was written shortly after the Jewish people had returned from exile, had returned as prisoners of war, and they had returned to a wrecked and demolished Jerusalem. It's been some decades now, and Jerusalem has been rebuilt, and the temple has now been restored. They have their towns and their villages. Their houses have been reestablished. And now these worshipers are swaying and moving as they walk slowly up the hill, as they walk slowly up for their service of worship. They're singing about a better time. As they're walking and swaying up the hill toward the temple, they are singing about a better time, a time when things were good. When the Lord brought the captives back to Zion, we were like men who dreamed. They are singing. They're remembering the days shortly after they had rebuilt their communities, their days shortly after they had rebuilt the temple, when their homes were fresh and new and you could smell the scent of fresh pine everywhere you turned. They're remembering the days when they dreamed big dreams for their communities and for their homes. One of them, perhaps his name is Yaakov. He's thinking about that day as he's walking up the hill. He's thinking about that day when he and his wife Leah had finished building their home. They had finished constructing their home, and they're standing now with their calloused hands one in another. And he's pointing out, he remembers the day he pointed out. He said, right over there. We'll put the garden right over there. I'm going to go back there and I'm going to sow the seeds of corn and radishes and tomatoes. And over here, I'm going to sow the seeds of a fig Newton tree. Yaakov had a little to learn about his trees. And he's remembering when Leah pointed to the side of the house and she said, I think we'll put the swing set over here for the day when we have children, and we'll put in a little sandbox, and I'm going to sow some seeds of wild flowers right over there, right from the front corner of the house, right over there. And they're remembering the day when they dreamed as they walked up now, up toward the temple of Jerusalem. They're remembering. They're remembering a better time. Listen to them singing. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. They're using now the present tense to remember the joy that once was. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. They're remembering it now as they ascend together toward the temple. They're remembering the deep joy that they experienced on the day that the temple was completed, when all of the work of the craftsmen was finally done, and when they walked through the gates into the temple for the first time in decades. They're remembering that day when they walked in and they saw the restored temple and the sounds of the voices of the people. It was like our choir sung by every member of the Jewish community. They're remembering the joy that they experienced that day. They're remembering the exhilaration of relationships, this excitement, this powerful fellowship of men and women and children who share a dream of the beauty of their community. They have a vision of what love one another can look like in their reestablished Jerusalem, and they're remembering how powerful and how beautiful all of that was. And then, have you ever had a time in your life when you've experienced deep and powerful joy, profound, beautiful joy? And then it is as though somebody has dropped a wrecking ball on the foundations of your joy and the whole thing has come crumbling apart. That's what these people's experience is like on this day. The imagination that they had for their connections of their community, their oneness, their unity that they would experience as God's people has given away to the bitter strifes and the arguing and the frustrations of people acting human. Their dreams of living in this community have been smothered by the Samaritans who lived just a little ways to the north of them. Samaritans who had remained behind all the years that the Jews had been in captivity and now are understandably resentful that the Jews have come back to reclaim this homeland. Folks, this isn't the first generation in which folks have fought over that land. And now they're in the middle of all that strife. And then there's all the internal stuff that's going on. There's the stuff where they grumble about what kind of government that they ought to have, who their leaders should be. There's one group of people, the Tea Party of Jerusalem, who are staring in icy cold stares against the Occupy Judea folks, and they have differing visions of what life ought to look like in the new and reestablished Jerusalem, and now things are hard. They're remembering the day when they imagined the gardens that would be all over Jerusalem and an economy that would be so robust that there would not be a single person who would have any need, and instead they've now lived under years of the unrelenting and tormenting sun. Drought season after drought season, the streams of the Negev have now dried up and are cracked and they are parched and people are begging on the streets and they're looking at one another and, well, if you've ever had a time in your life when you had known joy and then it was as though somebody had just pulled it out from under you, you can appreciate what these folks are singing as they move upward and upward. Listen to the mourning tones of this psalm. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like the streams in the Negev, restore. There's a word you use only when you've had something that is now lost. Restore our fortunes, O Lord. I don't know about you, but in my own ranking of the hierarchies of life's disappointments, this one has got to be close to the top. The disappointment of having known joy, only to have it whisked away, so that now joy is a memory instead of a contemporary experience. I don't know about you. For me personally, this ranks in the very top of those hierarchy of life's disappointments. Lisa was born in November of 1918. She was born in Berlin. Now, that's a very significant time to be born in Berlin. November of 1918, those of you who remember your history will remember that that is not only the year in which World War I came to an end, that is the season in which World War I came to an end. And it was a hard, hard time to be born in Germany. Germany had lost that war, and they were now forced to make reparations, to make huge payments for the rebuilding of Europe out of their own economy. They had to pay other countries to start rebuilding their nations. And it led to a time of enormous inflation, which led immediately into a time of deep, deep, powerful depression in this country. Lisa was born in November of 1918. Now, somewhere around her 10th birthday, her parents had been hatching some dreams. For some time, no doubt, they had been incubating these dreams, and their dreams were now beginning to hatch. They had decided that they were going to move their family across the Atlantic Ocean to the United States of America. She was 10 years old when she and her family got on board the ship, set sail from Germany to the United States of America, dreaming big dreams. They knew people in Saginaw, Michigan. There was a German community in Saginaw. And so they knew people. They knew people who would look for work for them. And the economy was robust in America in the mid-1920s. It was an expanding and beautiful economy. They had dreams of jobs and dreams of a home and dreams of meeting their kids' needs in different ways. And it was a time of dreaming. When they landed on Ellis Island in the United States of America, you can imagine this family's joy as they arrived in a new world, in a new place, and a new time in, are you ready for this? 1929, just before the crash of the stock market, just before the American economy did essentially the same thing that the economy in Germany had done, and these people who dreamed big dreams suddenly had to deal with the harsh, powerful realities of life in America in 1929. Can you believe that? I don't know about you. To me, this ranks among the top of the hierarchy of disappointments. To have known joy and dreamed dreams, only to see all of that come crashing to the ground right in front of you. C.S. Lewis was a British author, a beautiful British author. Many of you are familiar with him. A powerful Christian writer and defender of the gospel. Many of you know him best by his books, The Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis didn't get married until his late 50s. He married a lady by the name of Joy Davidman Gresham. The two of them, by all accounts, had a very beautiful and happy marriage. They were deeply in love with one another and were enjoying the middle years of their lives with each other when Joy became very ill. And so C.S. Lewis gathered some of his closest friends around him, and he said, "Let's pray." And so they began to pray, and they prayed fervently for his wife. And in ways that medical science could not understand, in ways that made no sense to the physicians, her health was restored. She had a comeback that was extraordinary. People were overwhelmed with joy. Can you imagine the joy? And then, remission. And then things went south. And then this man who was deeply in love and deeply faithful was planning and preparing for a service for his wife. I don't know about you. For me personally, that is at the very top of the hierarchy of the greatest disappointments of life. I have a friend who had a very, very powerful spiritual experience. It was the real deal, really authentic. Over a course of many, many months, my friend had an experience of the love of God that was deep and profound and beautiful. It changed her sense of who she was, who she is. It changed her sense of her own identity. This didn't last a weekend or a week. It went on month after month after month, a beautiful and powerful and prolonged sense of God's presence and power. And not only that, she experienced Christian fellowship, Christian community, as though it were the book of Acts, men and women and people working together in unity and the sense of God's Spirit dwelling in them and among them. This went on for months. I believe it was very authentic and very real. And then, off of the mountaintop for a variety of different reasons and thudding down in the valley of the harsh realities of life, and now in the valley, remembering the mountain. I don't know about you. To me, that comes pretty close to the top of the list of the disappointments of our lives. And so they are walking, they are swaying, they are singing as they move up the hill toward Mount Zion, these ancient Jewish worshipers. They're singing, "Restore our fortunes like the streams of the Negev." Like those streams that are dry through the summer months, cracked and parched and lifeless. And then come the winter and the spring rains, and these streams are transformed from places of death to places of life as they become an active way of living water, and around them is gathered the new green, rich, fertile growth and life. The psalmists, the people walking up the hill are praying, "Restore us like that." And their song, their chant continues. "Those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy." What? "He who goes out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return in joy, carrying the sheaves of harvest with him." What? They're dreaming again. These ancient Jews swaying and marching and singing on their way up to Mount Zion, they're dreaming again. Only these are not the dreams of people whose circumstances have suddenly changed to give them new dreams to dream. These aren't people who are dreaming new dreams because they just found it in themselves to do so. These are people who are dreaming new dreams because they believe in the God of promise. And they believe in the promises of God. Those two aren't the same thing, by the way. You can believe in the promises of God and they remain external to you. But when you believe in the God of promise, you're rooted in the God of promise. You're grounded in the God of promise. Your life is in the God of promise. And because your life is in the God of promise, you may be surrounded by absolute deadness and barrenness, but you still dream because the dream belongs to God. And these folks,
They're dreaming of a day when those who have gone out sowing with the tracks of tears staining their faces, they're going to come back one day with tracks of a different kinds of tears. They're going to come back one day having sown in tears. They're going to come back having reaped with the tears of joy. There will be laughter like you've never heard on the day that those folks return. Listen, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, this is one of those sissy, wimpy, positive thinking sermons, isn't it? You're thinking to yourself, this is another one of those think positive thoughts and good things will always happen to you rubbish messages, aren't you? You're thinking to yourself, there's more fluff to that positive thinking stuff than to the Ohio State Buckeyes. And that's a lot of fluff. But these folks who are singing and chanting and swaying on their way up to the temple, they're not like our generation. Don't mistake them for our generation. These aren't folks who are dreaming new dreams because their circumstances have suddenly changed. Look, every day in our generation, there are people whose tens of thousands of people whose blood pressure goes up and down every day based on the stock market, and I'm not even making that up. You could measure it. Tens of thousands of people whose blood pressure goes up and down based on the movements of the stock market. They're not like that. Their hope and promise is not rooted in their circumstances. And they also are not like our generation. We mistake promise for optimism. Optimism doesn't care about what's going on around you because it's got its head stuck in the sand. It doesn't know what's going on around you. Optimism just says, everything's going to turn out okay, everything's going to turn out okay. But promise says, my eyes are wide open to everything that is wrong with this world. And because I am rooted and grounded in God, I'm dreaming new dreams. Listen to the sidebar of some of their conversations as they're walking and swaying now on their way up to the temple and singing and chanting these songs. One of them pulls Yaakov to the side. One of them says to Yaakov, hey, what do you suppose the future under God's care is going to look like? And Yaakov says, well, I don't know, but I do know this. I know that when God created the heavens and the earth, it didn't depend on us. I know that when there was nothing but darkness and void, I know that when God said, let there be light, it ripped, baby, through the whole universe. Yeah, that's the source of this promise. One of them pulls Leah aside and says, Leah, do you remember about our ancestor Sarah, how she was old, she was as old as the grave, and she was barren? You remember how she was unable to have any children way beyond childbirth age? You remember how the Jewish race was going to end? Right there. And God said, now listen, don't worry. I'm going to give you a son. I want you to trust me. It will happen in my time. She says, Leah, what did Abraham and Sarah have to do in order to create that baby out of their barrenness? And Leah says, well, they did have a little bit to do with it. Yeah, maybe so. But all of the rest of it was in the hands of the God who creates where there is nothing, who gives life where you see only death, who has leverage where there is no leverage. One of them says, say, how is it that we ended up in the promised land, isn't it, anyway? Weren't we all slaves in Egypt, our ancestors many generations ago? Weren't we absolutely slaves in Egypt, powerless in this world? And didn't God come to our aid when we had absolutely nothing that we could do for ourselves? And didn't God work and act on our behalf until that day when we came into this land and God granted it to us as a gift? And all of them now, as they're swaying and moving on their way up to the temple, all of them now are singing because these folks, they know the difference between possibility thinking and promise. They believe. They believe. And their lives are rooted and grounded in the God of promise. Each of these three Sundays, counting this morning, I have reminded you that we are gathered between the first and the second advent of Jesus. I hope that you never grow tired of hearing that. I hope that that never grows so familiar to you that it just kind of sort of skips over your ears. Listen, you can never see a gorgeous sunset too many times. And if we have ears to hear, if we really have ears to hear, and hearts that are open, These words will cause a tingle on our spine every time we hear them. We are gathered this morning for worship between the first and the second advent of Jesus. The first one began ugly enough. The first one began with Jesus, Messiah, born to peasant parents, born and laid in a feeding trough because there was no room for them in the inn. Oh my gosh, the depth and the breadth of human darkness. The Messiah born and laid in the manger because there was no room for him in the inn. This is a humiliating beginning, if ever there was one. His story ends in a more humiliating way upon the cross on which he was crucified. Oh my, the depth and the callousness of human darkness. But on the third day, when there was absolutely no hope, hear that please, there was nothing that anyone could do, God raised Jesus Christ from the dead and brought life where there is nothing but darkness, and light where there is nothing but despair. Can you do that? I can't do that. Can you do that? On the third day, God raised Jesus Christ from the dead, and that day portends a day when he will return again. Now we're talking about the second advent of Christ, and on that day, risen Jesus will return, and he will judge the living and the dead. And on that day, he will overcome all of God's enemies, including death itself. And on that day, he will make all things new, and you and I are gathered for worship between the first advent of Jesus and the second. Do you feel the tingling yet? I want to ask you a question. Between the first advent of Jesus and the second advent of Jesus, do you believe that those who sow in tears will bring back a harvest of joy? Do you believe in your situations of darkness that where you can do nothing, God can still bring light? Do you believe that your little sowing of the seeds of trust and love can come back in an extraordinary harvest of laughter? Do you? In our church in Wyoming, we had this fellow, I'm going to call him John. John called my office one day to ask if he could set up an appointment. I'd never met him before. He said something odd about where he lived. I didn't quite make sense of it, and he said that the time in which he could make an appointment with me was very limited because he had to get a ride into the church. I didn't quite understand what he was saying. So we set an appointment. The next day, John came to my office, and he was not one to mince words. He sat down in my office, and he said, "Here's the deal. I am a recovering alcoholic. I am a recovering drug addict, and I've spent the last several years in prison for a serious felony." He described the felony. He said to me, 9 months ago, when I was in prison, a fellow prisoner who had become a Christian told me the story of Jesus and invited me to invite Christ into my life, and I am now a believer. I am now a follower of Jesus. And I'm now living in a transitional facility between prison and freedom, a transitional facility in which they're preparing me for the time when I will no longer be in prison. And then, without judgment, without anger, just directly and bluntly, he said, "Pastor, the legal system is not set up to help people like me succeed. The legal system is set up to help deal with people like me when we fail again." He said that without judgment, just bluntly. And then he said, "If I'm going to make it, I need to be connected to a community of people who will pray for me. If I'm going to make it, I need to be connected to a community of people that I can share my darkness with. And if I'm going to make it, I need to be connected to a community of people who believe that God gives life where there is no life." And he said, "Is this that kind of a church?" Now, I'd like to reframe his question in the language of the 126th Psalm. I think that what John was asking me that day was this: do you believe that people who sow in tears can reap with joy? Do you believe that God raises the dead to new life? Do you believe that God can create possibility where there is no possibility? Do you? Think about your situation right now, where you are. Think about the darkness where you are this morning. Some of you are dealing with relationships that have been broken, Some of you walking in the darkness of divorce. Some of you dealing with situations in your family in which you are separated and cut off from people that you care about very, very deeply, and it is a dark, dark, dark place. Let me ask you, do you believe that God can create light in that darkness? And here in the meantime, can you sow seeds of trust in the God who does that? Some of you are terribly discouraged this morning. Some of you are discouraged because your reputation has come under fire, sometimes falsely, when you've been accused of things that you did not do. And you're discouraged this morning. And what I want to ask you is, do you believe that God brings light where today you can only see darkness? Do you? Do you believe that you can sow in tears and that there will be a day when you will reap in laughter? Many of you are actively involved in ministry because our church believes that all of us are the ministers of the church. We say this over and over again. We say that we are a church of 300 and some odd ministers. And let me emphasize the word odd in certain cases. We're a church of 300 and some ministers, and some of you have been scattering seeds of love on behalf of the children of our community. You've been going to His Kids, and you've been working with children who are bearing the bruises and the pain of the families in which they're raised. You've been working with children who have parents who have mistaken punishment for discipline. Or in some cases, children whose parents have mistaken do whatever you want for love. Or in some cases, you've been dealing with some children who you can't tell if they've ever known love. And you've been sowing seeds, and you've been sowing seeds, and maybe so far you haven't seen anything except children bouncing off walls or despondent. Let me ask you, do you believe that while you sow in tears, that there will be a day when those tears come back as laughter? Do you? Some of you have been witnessing to loved ones and family members. You've been trying to share the good news for as long as you can remember, trying to find creative ways to share with your loved ones and your friends about the love of God and Jesus. And so far, all that you've gotten is cold hearts and words like, mind your own business. Do you believe that those who sow in tears will one day reap with laughter? We've got some people in our congregation who are unbelievably committed to the poor. Some people in our church who have decided to do with less so that other people could have enough. People who have lived simply and who make phone calls and who write letters and who work on behalf of some of the poorest people in the world. And you don't see any returns from your work. Do you believe that those who sow in tears will one day reap with laughter? Do you? I don't know if any of you in the second service have ever had this opportunity, but if you ever come to the first service, if you come a little bit early, you'll get to hear our choir warming up. They come in here, and they all gather together up here on the risers, and Pastor Ron gathers them, and he tells them to stop hitting each other. They're such children. And then Ron says, all right, let's warm up our voices. You'll hear something that sounds a little bit like this. La, 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 la. Only it sounds less like a horse dying than what you just heard. You'll hear that. And they'll go through the scales, and each time they'll press a little bit higher and a little bit lower as they warm up their voices. Do you believe that there will be a day when those who have sown with tears are going to reap songs of joy? Do you? Because if you do, the time to start warming your voice up, the time to start singing those songs, is right now. Because on the second advent of Jesus, folks, you're going to need to be ready to sing. Would you pray with me, please? You are the God who brings life where there is no life. You are the God who creates something where there is nothing. And you are the God who brings joy when we know only tears. Help us today, O God, to sow seeds of trust and love, in the full conviction that one day there will be extraordinary, universe-wide laughter. In the name of Jesus, we pray.